It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. Today's show is called Theater Interrupted, where we can be talking about the challenges of being an actor during a pandemic. We're going to talk about challenges of making a living as an actor before and during the pandemic, and what happens when non-acting jobs dry up. How do you further your career with closed venues? With today with us, we have two wonderful people, Rob Johansson, an actor. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be with you.
You too. And Shantae Gaston, an actress. Hi, Shantae.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Rob. It's good to be with you both here.
Hi, Shantae.
And I chose both of you because I admire and admire both of you for what you do. Your talent, your skill, and I think you exemplify both of you really well acting. But I know that the challenge of being an actor anyway is it's a little unlike any of the other arts in that you guys can be turned up and turned down in terms of employment market. Where there's union, you have unions, but it's not the same way. Musicians get represented and they have better things. You know, visual artists can get turned up and down, but they can, you know, go beyond that. But in an acting thing, you have to have a place that wants you, a venue to do it. And sometimes I know a lot of people, they'll get laid off for the summer, even if they have a full-time gig, you know, that it looks like it's going to go through, but then the summer they get laid off and they have to figure it out all over again. So I know that that's a tough part of being an actor and actress. But then we added on the pandemic and we added closed venues. We added masking for even actors and audiences. I think it was a really difficult time. So I'd kind of like to get a perspective from each of you as to what you were doing during that time, how you rolled with it, and where you see yourselves going now. Shantae, you want to start with that?
Yeah, sure. This is my beginning of the pandemic kind of coincides with a show I was doing. I was working, I was doing a show, had another one right after that I was going to go into. And I remember one day we were in rehearsal for the show I was currently doing. And they came in, the director and producer came in and we're like, okay, just so you know, there's kind of this COVID thing going around that people are talking about. We're just gonna, you know, watch it, monitor it, pay attention to ticket sales, and we'll see. We might have to maybe cancel one of the shows if we don't sell, that kind of thing. And we were all like, okay, that's understandable. Literally the next day we came into rehearsal and they were like, we're sending you all home until further notice. I mean, it was that abrupt. It was that quick. One day they were like, we're going to watch it. And the next day it was like, no, we're done. And kind of that way with everything else in my life too, you know, it was like everything just stopped all at once or within, you know, at least a few days. And so that's kind of, that rehearsal is like how I mark the beginning of the pandemic. It's associated with that. And then everything up even kind of until now was virtual for the most part. You know, I was lucky enough to be able to recently have done some outdoor shows, but now with the variants coming out, things are starting to take another turn. And, you know, even a show that I was in right now has now gone back to being virtual. It was going to be in person and they had to switch it again. So, you know, I was starting to get a bit optimistic and was like, oh, theater's coming back. We're coming back. And I do think it is. But also we're still kind of in this fight. So it's not over yet.
Yeah, I think that's really a great way of describing for the listeners exactly, you know, how difficult that is. You know, it's one thing knowing out a little while there might be something happening, but it's that constant day-to-day back and forth. Are we going to be open? We try to open, or you try to get a different job that's going to go, but then all of a sudden that evaporates. It's a really tough place. How about you, Rob?
Shante, I love hearing, I love and hate hearing the where, what, you know, the where were you when, because, you know, it's akin to, this pandemic has been akin to 9/11, Katrina, but of course on a global scale, you know, I'm thinking back to, like, you know, I'm a few squares older than Shante, so I'm thinking back to when I used to hear my parents talk about everybody knew where they were when JFK got shot, and Martin Luther King, and, you know, these markers. And for me, I was so fortunate in that I had 18 months of work lined up. And I remember thinking about that, and COVID had already, like, we had heard about it. And we would muse. I was doing a show at IRT, and we opened, and I remember at the Toast, that was in February. And Janet Allen said, you know, well, you know, it's crazy times right now, but thank God we have theater. And one of the cast, we were in the dressing room getting out of costume after opening night. And he was, what do you think is going to happen? And this guy who was playing Perrault in Murder on the Orient Express, he said, you know, Rob, the Midwest, there's no way it's going to shut down. People are too hardy. And, you know, it's just a great, nobody knew what a wallop this was going to be for the world, and of course, particularly for people whose livelihoods count on being in a large room in an old building that now we've come to learn has no ventilation, you know, or limited. You know, it's tricky. And now looking forward, boy, oh boy, how do we move forward? And my wife Jen was in a show, and I also got to give a shout out. Shante, you rocked in Midsummer. Rocked.
Thank you.
Great. And I was lucky enough, you know, Shante said she just did an outdoor show, and I was lucky enough to be a fight choreographer again and flex those muscles. And oh my God, the first rehearsal, I was in the room bouncing around with people. I was like, oh, it just felt so good to be back, you know? And I watched Shante grow throughout that process, and your wall was amazing. It was so good. It was so good. So, going backwards, I remember I was with my wife in Ohio. She was at the Human Race Theater she was playing the lead role in a show about Gloria Steinem. And I went out in March and saw her show on March 12th. And that is, as you, everybody knows, the world was getting dark quick. And I showed up, and it was the artistic director, who is a friend of mine, we big hug, and he's like, well, I'm glad you came, because who knows, this could be it. And time changed so fast. I was like, dude, you're always an alarmist. Come on, calm down. It was the last night of their show. And I'm so glad I got to see it, because it was a great show. And as I was driving home from Ohio that night, I was listening to a hockey game, and I got a notification that the NBA had canceled their season. And then the next day, the NHL had canceled their season. So the world just shut down. And like Shante, now the world has opened back up a little bit. I have the immense good fortune to hope that I'm going to be playing Scrooge this winter at the IRT. And I say hope, and I do, look, it's going to happen because the IRT did a wonderful thing and they had a virtual season last year that I was lucky enough to be a part of. I know that worst case scenario, we're going to film that sucker. But best case scenario is we'll be back in the room in some capacity, 8 shows a week. And I know, Mark, we're all over the place, but I also want to say for arts organizations, for people that run the organizations, I think everybody's taking a look at this art form, both as far as a pandemic and as far as how we treat ourselves as working artists. You know, theater is a hard art form. And I love all these heads of the arts organizations that I know are reevaluating. We don't want artists to kill themselves for their art. So I feel like people are being a little more humane with how long we rehearse, how many shows they expect us to do a week. It's just, it's the pandemic has let us have this immense reevaluation of what it is we do. So it'd be fun to talk about that.
Thanks, Whit.
And I'm just so you guys know, I'm in my other passion, I'm at the Humane Society right now, and I've just been joined by one of the most lovely pit bulls in the world. So just so you know.
Oh, I love pit bulls.
Oh, great.
In case you hear a bark, but he's normally okay. Pretty quiet.
Well, so one of the things that both of you talked about, and I think it's true that what the public sometimes, not everybody, but gets a sense is, I think we get a sense of that, you know, actors make it big like they do in film, certain ones. And even though those can struggle, but they will do that. And they'll think, oh, you know, they can really make this into a profession and make a living doing it. That, I think, then leads to the idea that lead to some of the abuses that I think happen to actors and actresses. And I think that you get to where, you know, people don't realize that they pay a fairly good price to go to a theater, but they pay nowhere near the actual cost of operation. And so you may both know, but for a while I operated the American Cabaret Theater as the operating person. And I got to tell you that we may be brought in with admissions and everything sold out, even on a really good show. We might have only brought 30 to 35% of what the cost of a production was when you add everything back in. And so that means that you've got to be out fundraising and you've got to be full house anyway. So here we come crashing into the pandemic. And it's not only do we close some houses, but when we do try to open, we are in partial house mode. Mm-hmm. Then we're trying to get sponsors and donors to really step up for something that we can't promise that we're even going to be able to do. I just think you guys landed in the profession you're in a really tough spot.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what kept you guys in the game?
Well, along that vein, theater did stop, you know, and the theater that we know of did stop. And so what I found most theaters and theater companies try to do was find an alternative route to bring theater to people. And in my experience, theater companies that didn't have a theater house, they're not specifically housed somewhere, did a little better with it because they are kind of used to not having to fill a space anyway. But even theater houses, you know, had to find, okay, how can we do theater, but not the way we know how to do it. And that was largely by being virtual in most cases, which, you know, I am so grateful for that. I was able to still have work, not the same amount and obviously not the same capacity, but I was still working throughout the pandemic. But virtual theater is very, very different from live theater. It's just not the same. And I'm glad that it was able to happen. Well, one, you've got all the technical aspects of it, right? Everybody's Wi-Fi is different. Reaction times are stalled. somebody's glitching, we can't hear somebody else, they're muted. You know, you've got all that going on. But on top of that, you can't replace being in a room with an audience and other actors and feeling all these energies and really looking someone in the face and reacting in real time. You just don't get that same thing through a screen. It just feels different. To me, it doesn't feel like theater. Again, I don't want to sound ungrateful because I'm very, very grateful that I still was able to work in some way, but it was different. It was very, very different. And it took an adjustment. And I think audiences too had to adjust a little bit. And then we were able to, move forward with it. And now it's kind of the norm in some ways, especially for, meetings and things like that, kind of outside of the artistic world. But it was something that you had to kind of change your mindset and switch into a different gear to be able to do, or at least it was for me.
I echo those sentiments. Felt very lucky that I had a teaching gig at Wabash College, which I loved, and luckily that was not virtual. It was in person, except for, since I live in Indianapolis and they're up north, about an hour north, northwest, there were a couple of weather-related days where I had to teach, and I was teaching yoga and comedy from the stage. They're laughing because I'm getting licked by a pit bull right now. I had to teach two classes virtually, and Shantae's point, even teaching, man, try to teach a yoga class online, try to teach an acting class online. Oh man, shoot me in the face. It's the worst, because you're not in the same room. And also I was so lucky that I got to do a one-man show. I got to do the one-man version of It's a Wonderful Life for the Indiana Repertory Theater. But here's, and look, I was so grateful, and I still am really grateful that I got to do that. But from the first day of rehearsal until the day we filmed, I had physical interaction with three people: the director, the stage manager, and the production assistant. And even that, they couldn't get close to me. They could be in the same room with me. We were getting COVID tests 3 times a week. Good precautions. And it's funny, like what Shantae said, now we've reached a new normal. And Zoom meetings, I mean, look at, we're conducting this radio interview, not for so much, I think, for safety's sake, but because this is how the three of us could get together. We've realized that there's some benefit to Zoom, but I think we have to be very careful as a community of letting the interactive part of being in the same room drift away from us, because there's nothing better. And I know there's not, theater and sports have a lot in common, but some theater people absolutely hate sports, so forgive me. But just looking at sporting events that have, they resumed in empty arenas, and that, while cool, boy oh boy, did you miss that element of the fans. Same thing for us. That automatic response of, we're reading an audience, And Shantae, you're in a Fringe show right now, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not? I thought you were. Okay. I'm real lucky because right now I'm doing a Fringe show with Defiance Comedy, and all the audience is masked, but we're allowed to have big houses, and it's heavenly. It's absolutely heavenly. And then I think about, and this is not a dig on any of the, IRT did everything they could to make the virtual experience awesome. But I can't tell you how many people were like, well, I bought a ticket. Now I can't, my computer can't find it. It cut off, whatever. I bought 5 tickets trying to get online. I never did, So, oh my God, there's no substitute of just being in the damn room.
No, and I think we've found, I do think, as arts organizations, and particularly in theater, we did find there were some things that we tried that we should continue. And there were many other things that just don't work as well because we really need the audience there. But one of the things I think that did change was art organizations that were able to do some pivoting and were able to not do it exactly like it was in the house, do something a little different. I think they found that they might have had an international audience. They might have had, you know, people who could tune in, and that was a wonderful thing to be different. However, it doesn't replace, I think, what theater is, and you guys correct me, but I think it's very communal. And I don't mean communal for just the audience, but it's between the audience members, but also the stage. And you guys really have a symbiotic relationship. And in the best evenings, I recall from talking to actors, are the ones where the audience has got you, they're with you, and they're fueling you. The worst ones are when they're half dead, which you can have a half dead audience sometimes, and you're pulling to get something to happen. And I would imagine that those times being virtual is like that. Your audience is delayed. They're not together. They can't react in the way, and you can't sense that in real time. You can't hear the buzz. You can't sense the heat going up, people getting squirmy in their seats. Or, I mean, I know that as actors, you're looking at all that. Can you describe then why is that so important to theater? Why is that live audience so important?
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of taught as an actor that, like, you can't, you have to have your performance and everything ready, despite what the audience is, you know, even if you have, like you said, a half asleep audience, you know, you can't have a worse performance because of that, right? But you do know what it feels like when you have an audience that is right there with you. You know, you do know what it feels like when you're supposed to be funny and the audience dies laughing. You know, not that you don't give your best always, but, or try to at least, but you do feel that, you know, you do feel that energy regardless of what it is. And when it's virtual, you don't get any energy, whether half sleep or if they're right there with you, you know, you're kind of hoping for the best and being like, I hope this is reading. I hope this is working. Same even like across, if you're doing a scene or with other people, you know, you're trying your best to make sure that chemistry is there and whatever you're trying to get across is reading. But you know, it's a screen, so you can only do so much and kind of just hope for the best, you know. Even in rehearsals, you can feel, if you're working a scene, you can feel, okay, it needs this, I need to do, you know, you can kind of maneuver it, and you kind of miss that when you're doing virtual. You can't really play off that energy the same way you can in a room when you have the people there with you.
Yeah, so it's for you, it's very much like an opening night is important. It's different than rehearsal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you
I mean, that's the first time you have, I mean, you have some practice ones with some audiences, but boy, opening night of a show, that's the first time that you got a whole lot of energy in the room.
Right, yeah, there's, I mean, that feeling, that energy you have in you, that excitement and the nervousness, you know, it's, you kind of, I found I didn't get all that when it was virtual, especially because, you know, normally in theater you're doing oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes you're doing multiple shows, whereas when it's virtual you're kind of just recording it and sending it out there. You know, you don't get to like experience the different audiences or oh, Sundays are like this and Fridays are like this. You kind of all of that is gone.
And you know, with you guys, you all know this well, but except for something like Shakespeare, and even then it happens, but where you have to stay kind of to the script. But in real live theater, show after show, they're a little different. Rhythms, mm-hmm. rhythms are different, timing's different, things fall apart on the stage, props don't work, people lose their fake beards. I mean, you have to adapt. And I think the audience really benefits, as well as the actors, from that experience. And I can imagine there's no way that happens virtually, because you can refine it until you got a product that's more finished, but I don't sure that's the same product.
Well, and that's, you know, Shante speaks to like you do it once, you build a rehearsal and then you film it once and there it goes. And how many times have you heard actors say, or an audience member that might have liked the show enough to see it two times, one time the week of previews and then one time in the middle of the run, and they'll go, oh my God, it's grown so much.
Yeah.
It's like making a really good bowl of chili. The first night where it's ready to eat, it's good, but man, let it hang out. Let it That's grow right. on each other. And then after a couple of days, it's really good. So I feel like we've been, you know, gypping ourselves of that process. And, you know, I also wanted to speak to, I love organizations that do talkbacks with audiences. I am one of those actors. I love talkbacks. I will attend every one of them. As a matter of fact, when we did It's a Wonderful Life, I was like, I know I'm not going to have a live audience, but how can I interact with audiences? So we set up, I think we did like 6 talkbacks with groups of people who had seen the show. It was just fun to do that. But when an audience is live, one thing I've learned over the years, if there's a quiet audience, and it is easy for, you know, actors to go, oh man, they're not with us. We're going to try. But damn, you know, they might walk off stage going, hey, those guys, they stunk. Bah, no feedback. Come on. But then I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a talk back with an audience that I thought was quiet and maybe disinterested. And what they said during the talk back, 9 times out of 10, they were riveted, but they weren't vocal. And you know, Shante and Mark, well, you both know this. An audience is primal and kind of feeds off each other. And I feel like there are some audiences that in the opening scene or two, they'll develop their own vocabulary of whether or not they're going to be vocal. And it doesn't mean that they're into it or not. It means they've either because there's a few key people that have some fear and don't want to be vocal, maybe they're introverted. So the culture of that night is the audience isn't going to be vocal. And I think too often us actors can be like, oh, screw those guys. They're terrible. No, that's not. And you know what? Sometimes maybe, but a lot of times they've just developed this audience culture of, nope, we're going to be quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, so
yeah.
we got to remember not to give up on those quiet audiences, because sometimes right. Let's just call them cerebral
audience, or it's just the evening, right? You know,
yeah.
The rhythms happen to all of us, the actors too. Actors can not be quite as you know, on either with one another in the timing. Again, everything's timing and having things right.
That's right.
We're talking with both Rob Johansson and Shante Gaston about the challenges of being an actor during a pandemic. We have related it to the good day old chili. And so we'll talk more after this break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Rob Johansson and Shante Gaston about challenges of being an actor during a pandemic. And one of the things when we left for the break that I wanted to kind of pursue was the idea of that when you're on stage and you're interacting with one another and you're interacting with an audience, so much of what happens has to do with timing. You know, when whether something looks real, like you're chopping a head off that you're not really chopping off, or when you have a fight scene to make it real, or you even just have a place where you want some sense of feedback from the audience just how long to hold, with like there are laugh lines sometimes in something built in, or there's a pause for because they emotionally need time, and you read them and you get that. How important is timing in all this, and how did that change when you go virtual?
Yeah, you're right. Timing is very important. When it's virtual, honestly, I don't know. You can't really do that. You know, if you pause, a lot of times, you know, you can tell if there's a line in a show that's going to get a really big laugh, that tends to get a really big laugh. You know that, and you factor in your head, I know I'm going to need to pause here to wait for that. You're not going to get that when it's virtual. You know, it's going to be awkward if you're pausing and waiting for laughter, you know? So I don't know. You just kind of, again, I kind of mentioned it before, you just kind of do your best and hope that it works. It's that all of that, that's really different timing and knowing when something, you know, sometimes you can give a certain emotion or a certain effect with just a pause, or, you know, the way you go into a line, if you wait, or if you go straight into it, or even things like cutting people off, you know, even that was a challenge because, again, there's sometimes a delay when it's virtual, when you got people in different places, you know, you kind of have to figure all that out. So you kind of just, I don't have a great answer. You just do your best and hope that it goes well.
There it is. You know what? I think I had an unfair advantage. Shati, I'm trying to remember what is the virtual show that you did? Or
so I never did a full virtual show. Everything virtual I did was I guess there were readings. Okay. So that was, but everything was like scenes, or improv was actually much easier than scripted things. But just like, everybody learn your lines and we're going to record this. I've got one coming up, but I did not have to do that during the pandemic.
Okay. I'm lucky in that. Well, lucky in one way. The biggest virtual thing that I did was the one person show. So Jen, my wife Jen had to do a show, the house that Jack built, full cast, and I could tell they were challenged by whether there's definitely a laugh line here, but because there was a full cast, they said it felt awkward to play a laugh amidst each other in the silence.
Yeah.
I was fortunate in a way in that it was just me, and I definitely played the laugh, and I played some pauses. I mean, you know, because I'm a big schmactor. I'm a big waka waka idiot. And what I did was I imagined, you know, I come from a big family. I'm the last of seven kids. And one of my favorite things to do is be at my mom's house around a table with all my siblings and their husbands and wives and my nieces and nephews and telling stupid stories together. I imagined doing that entire play as if I was sitting around my mom's table. And I kind of used my imagined timing of my family's responses to kind of instinctually play the laughs. And as weird as it was to watch myself, because, oh my God, I think a lot of stage actors are like, yeah, I'm a stage actor because I never want to see myself. Oh, oh my God. I when I did watch it, I was pretty happy with how I played the laughs. It didn't feel odd. And one cool thing, I wasn't going to watch it, because I didn't want to watch myself. And my wife, Jen, was like, if you don't watch this with me, I will be so mad at you. She didn't say, I'll be so mad. She said something else that I won't repeat. But she convinced me to watch. And I watched it with Jen and then with our good friend, Tony Smith, who's was a costumer at IRT for a bunch of years, and she's just awesome. But Tony laughed exactly as I thought the audience would. And I played the pauses. She filled them really nicely, and it worked out pretty well. So I had the cool experience of watching the product and being in the audience. And that was one of the coolest things about doing a virtual show. We don't get to watch ourselves from the audience, you know, very, very regularly. And once I got over the fact that I was like, who would want to see this gawky, lanky, bald guy? I got over that, and then it was fine, you know? So.
Yeah. I don't think people realize we, most of us do that all the time with the radio. I always go, I hate to hear myself. Like, why did I go, or did I insert this, or what am I doing with my voice? Or I got tongue tied. You find all the things that you could have, you're like the worst critic. That's mm-hmm. you like, don't want to do that. So I get that, you know. Earlier when we started it, we were talking about that it was tough during this time. So for both of you, you had jobs that continued, but you also didn't have the full opportunity of all that you wanted. Plus, there was a big unknown all the time. Where was I going to be in a month from now in terms of income, and what was I going to do? How did each of you as an actor and actress deal with that? What did you do? What became your, in a way, what saved you during that time so that you could come back when theater comes back?
Even when I'm doing theater, usually have another job going. So thankfully I had that, and we did get laid off, but only for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. So I was really fortunate. It was one of the biggest struggles with that was nobody knew how long this was going to last. And especially in the beginning, you know, everybody was very optimistic and, you know, we're just postponing this show until, you know, a couple months, or we're going to bring this back. And then things, as we're still dealing with this, things did not move along as quickly as we thought they would. Things did not go back to normal, whatever normal is, as quickly as we thought. And so, whereas we started, at least I was a little optimistic and be like, oh, actually, maybe I do need just a little break and then we can get back into the swing of things. And then it started to go on longer and longer. And then that's when it was like, okay, this may be how things are for a minute. And so, as well as, like I said before, a lot of people adjusted and did virtual. It was kind of a mental adjustment as well, because I'm used to gigging. I'm used to going from one thing to the next and just, you know, moving around, moving. And that wasn't happening in that way, you know. So I had to mentally adjust. And I am very grateful that I did still have a job. And I was grateful for even other gigs. They weren't acting gigs or theater gigs, but just other ways that I could make money doing things like that. I was very grateful for as well, because, you know, theater, the way we knew it stopped, but bills didn't, you know, so you still have to find a way to make money and make sure you could continue to take care of business.
Yeah, that's part of being a person in the theatrical arts from the get-go. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody thinks it's not going to be, but everybody starts there. And maybe it builds a sense of resilience, like you're saying, into that you've had to do that since the beginning. So maybe you can still go back and do that. Rob, what about you?
I feel very lucky the pandemic was a teacher for us all. People lost loved ones. And it feels really weird, but I've said to people, somewhat tongue in cheek, you know, as pandemics go, I've had a pretty good one, which is a horrible, I say that and I want to make sure people know that I'm being somewhat sarcastic, but there is also a little bit of truth in that. I decided when theater, I mean, it shut and I looked at my options and I decided for the first time in my life, I was going to go on unemployment. And I did that with the understanding that I had been listed as an essential employee with the Humane Society, even though I'm a volunteer. And I've been a volunteer here for 9.5 years, and I work with a lot of dogs that aren't, they come to us not ready to go into houses yet, so they need to get acclimated to people a little bit more. And I love this this job, this passion, whatever, almost as much as acting, maybe more in some ways. Anyway, I looked at this as an immense opportunity since I was on unemployment, and yeah, I got that stimulus for a little while. I thought the government is paying me to keep the Humane Society up and running. There was a time that there were six of us doing a lot of the day-to-day stuff in the shelter. And for those of you who've never been here, the Humane Society can house over 200 animals. So the fact that we were on such a skeleton crew, I didn't feel bad about taking unemployment because I was here usually 6-7 days a week. It became my full-time job, even though I'm a volunteer. So I just shifted my focus. And I've often had a part of me that I thought I could not put down acting, but I could make that my secondary thing and care for animals because who doesn't love dogs? Come on. It's the best. So I was able to soldier through the pandemic by coming to the Humane Society. There was a very low risk of COVID because I was dealing with animals. And the fact that I was dealing with the animals that weren't readily available for adoption, there were days that I'd be here for hours and hours and hours, I might see one human. So I was really fortunate in that way because I'm somebody that when the pandemic hit, selfishly, I thought if I have to stay home, I'm gonna go out of my mind. And I know that's somewhat self-serving. But I didn't feel like I ever was taking a risk with my health or other people's health by coming to the Humane Society. So I got very lucky that I was able to keep a passion during it. Yeah,
that's wonderful.
You mentioned thinking about whether or not you would switch gears and do this over acting, and honestly, that's. Theater is difficult when it's going well, you know, like there's an unknown. You're not guaranteed to always have work. You know, I'm very grateful that I have been blessed to be able to work often, but there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that you're always going to have a job when it's up and running. And here we are in the pandemic and it's not running. Theater's not running. And so I definitely had a lot of times where I was thinking like, I could just figure out how to get a regular job, right? And it would at least be more stable than this. Everybody was struggling in the pandemic, you know, but theater really struggles. And theater is a struggle when there's not a pandemic. And yeah. So I definitely had thoughts about, and if I thought I could be happy doing that, I 100% would have. I would have gotten just a regular job and been like, I know that I'm going to make this much each week. I know that this is what's coming in. This is what I can spend. And it's consistent. Because theater's not. And so that you mentioning that brought up another like mental thing that you had to deal with, or I had to, and I know a few other people that I've spoken to who have careers in the arts also thought about, like, just having that security was like a big thing.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Yeah. And I think security all the way around, it goes hand in hand with the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. And so I think it affects theater in more ways than maybe some others, not totally. I don't want to generalize too much, but I do think that you're right. I do think there is a kind of, can you get a job? Can you not? You're auditioning. You're kind of putting yourself out there and you're auditioning with a gazillion other people who are really talented often. And you have that, the whims of what are they looking for? And you're trying to fit yourself into that. And sometimes you can't. And then you have that rejection again and again, and that's hard to bounce back from. So I think your words of that, even in the best of times, I think being an actress is hard. I think it's also, it makes it even rougher when it really becomes unknown. And I think that was, both of you made a key point that during the pandemic, it was that you didn't know how long, because nobody really knew, you know, and nobody knew where their finances were going to be. Yeah. You all know that I run a small nonprofit. I didn't know from month to month where the next set of income was coming from, because donors didn't know whether they're going to give. We didn't know. And I work with everybody as contractors. And there were times that I had to say to them, I don't know if we're going to make this. I don't know if this is going to happen. I don't know if I can spend the money to do what we said, because I just don't know. And so you guys, that, I think you captured that really well. But I'd kind of like to take us for this last few minutes down a little different path and ask you all, what is it that fuels you when you get past that's there always the shadow of am I going to have enough to make my rent, or what am I going to do, or am I going to get the next job? But what is it that fuels you when you actually go forward with something? So where does that drive and passion come from? You want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that, you kind of hit it right on the nose when you said it's the passion, right? Like, I do it because I love it. And it fulfills me in a way that other things I've done have not. That's how I know, I alluded earlier that if I could get a regular job, I would. If that would fulfill me and make me happy the way theater does, then that's what I do, but it doesn't. So theater is what does that for me. Theater is what makes me feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Especially now, you know, a lot of theaters and theater companies are doing theater with the purpose, you know, they're doing shows that have a meaning behind them, or that are trying to teach people something. And that's like home for me right there. You know, that's something that I just don't get doing anything else that I've tried doing. I don't get it anywhere else.
All right.
A couple of things. The toiling of rehearsing to try and bring a story to life can sometimes be so frustrating and then so fulfilling. And it's that amazing work of, you know, trying to lift a story from the page and from the page to the stage. And then getting that to fruition and then sharing it with an audience that's in the room, you know, thinking about those moments of toil and the moments of doubt that you had in the rehearsal room. And then so many times those moments lead to people coming up that have just seen the show that clearly were blown away by the story that you told. That arc of that journey is unlike any other job you can have, you know? It's funny, you know, people that have quote unquote regular jobs, they'll apologize for not seeing a show. And I'm like, hey, if you don't want to, or you didn't make it, that's totally fine. I don't when's the last time I came to watch you work? You know, so don't feel bad about that. You know, don't feel an onus that you got to see everything just because that happens to be my job, you know, but I am grateful when people do want to come see a show. Especially, you know, if somebody doesn't come to everything, but there's something that intrigues them and they come and they're blown away by it, man, you just think about that. That's to have that as a job is amazing. So I do think, you know, we've been talking about the unsteadiness and the insecurity of it. I think we have to just take that as part of the deal, because it's, you know, life is a balance. And when you've got a job as kick butt as theater, there's gonna be instability. There has to be. It is, unfortunately, it's part of the deal. But thank goodness that there have been people who have more stable things going on in their lives who love theater, who are like, let's support this. You know, I feel like that's, as I've gone along and, you know, as I've learned, oh my God, I never realized in my young days as an actor, how much theater relies on donation. You know, like you said, Mark, a full house meet, oh great. Well, that's gonna pay for 40% of the production. But thank God there are people with maybe a little more stable lives that are like, yeah, I have a stable life, but also I'll go out of my mind without theater. So they put forth some help. I think that's a lovely balance, you know. So,
and I'm really excited about the expansion of theater as well. You know, more and more theaters are telling more stories, different stories, giving different opportunities, and in turn, that's also going to do that for the audience. You know, that's going to diversify your audience. That's going to reach more people than it would before. Obviously, as a Black woman, I'm grateful for that, for as far as what that means for work. But also, I think that's better all around for everyone. You know, that means that more people will come to the theater, more people will want to support, because now it's not just one set of people, one type of people that are seeing themselves represented or connecting to stories. You have so many different people who are now like, oh, I can see myself up. I understand that. I get that story that's being told. That's just going to broaden your audience and broaden people who want to support and broaden who you'll come in contact with and who you're going to teach and learn from. And I think that's just, I hope it continues in this vein.
I do too. And Shante, I think that's a really important point, that idea of theater with a purpose. And I think it always has. Sometimes it's entertaining. There's nothing wrong with it being something being entertaining. And it couldn't be entertaining. It could be entertaining and also, transformative at the same time. But I think you're right. And I do think theater has a unique ability. And maybe this pandemic has helped us, as well as things that are going on in the world around us with Black Lives Matter and gay and lesbian issues and all that, the national dialogue being polarized around those. Maybe that's pushing theaters to rethink a little bit. Are there ways that I can establish a provocation, something that makes people think? But I think it's unique. How would you describe, what's the unique abilities, both of you, for theater to be able to tackle subjects that we might not be able in public discourse to tackle?
Well, I think theater is kind of a safe space for that, right? Because if you are struggling with whatever issue it is, if it's LGBTQ or racial issues or political, whatever it is, you can watch a show and somebody up there is maybe playing a character that thinks how you think or believes what you believe, feels how you feel, whatever that is. And you can see a scenario play out and see a character learn and grow without feeling attacked, without feeling like somebody is coming at you and now, you know, it kind of puts you at a stop because you feel like this is coming at me and I don't know how to deal with this. If you can see it up there, you can identify with it and understand it and learn from it in a safe way. You feel like you're not on display for everyone to see you going through it. And also you can experience something that you had never thought about. You know, you can learn that people, with this whole, we are talking about the pandemic, but one of the things that was going on along with it was like this racial awakening, right? And so one of the main things that I heard was, you know, Black people are coming out and saying all these things that you have to deal with, just regular things for Black people that other cultures had no idea we were going through. You know what I mean? Like things that we have to think about on a daily basis that someone else didn't even know was happening. That's another avenue for theater. That's another way that theater can show you other people's stories and can teach you what's happening, and in turn makes you understand and empathize. And now you can leave having a different outlook at something. You know, you might be able to see something from a different way now. And then now you can go and share that with somebody else, even if they didn't come to the theater. You know, you can now tell them what's going on, or if you hear something that's slightly off, you can say, well, actually, this is kind of where that comes from. You know, like it can literally change lives.
Rob?
I, you know, one thing that I love, and of course, this is an interesting topic because here I am, you know, I am as white as they come. And so speaking of this, it's tough for me to go, okay, you know, I'm much more entitled, maybe without even realizing it. But it's been an awakening for me in a lot of ways. And in my still narrow perspective that hopefully is widening, one thing that I've loved is that casts, both in shows that have a message about what we're going through in the Black Lives Matter movement and others, you know, shows that are being produced with that message in mind, but also shows that, well, let's take, for example, Midsummer Night's Dream. That was a cast that I felt had a lot of diversity in it. And that story was told so beautifully, more beautifully, because of the diversity of the cast. And we, now Shantae, I wanna ask you, Shantae, have you done a lot of Shakespeare?
Not a lot, no. Actually, Midsummer was only my second full production.
And I bring it up because our friend Daniel Martin, who played Demetrius.
Lysander.
He played Lysander, son of a gun. Right, Adam Tran played Demetrius. Mm-hmm. I thought of that because Daniel Martin was screaming Demetrius. that was his first Shakespeare. And the fact that part of the mission with Indie Shakes is, you know, trying to be more diverse with the casting to represent the people around where that park is, you know, we want, as you said, Shantae, we want a diverse audience. We don't want theater to be an old boys club anymore. And to watch Daniel experience Shakespeare, acting Shakespeare for the first time, and early on, he was saying things like, you know, akin to a person picking up a guitar for the first time, like, how does this work? And then by the time you guys were up and running, he was a world-class guitarist. I mean, he was owning the language and having such a good time and incorporating, he has a really great improvisational background. So, which oddly enough, as structured as Shakespeare is, but I love improv too. So I feel like there's room for that. Yeah. And I watched him own it. And it was a lovely thing to see a human being come into Shakespeare for the first time and just have a ball. And casting, you know, casting is changing, and that's going to continue to afford people opportunities, new opportunities that didn't have them before. So that's really wonderful.
I want to thank you both for that, for the honesty of how theater can be a tool for us to open dialogues, to change the lives of the people performing as well as people in the audience in ways that we can receive that. Much of what you were talking about, Shante, is really true. I want to thank both you, Rob Johansson and Shante Gaston, for helping us explore all these. Until next week, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.